Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida legislature moves to tighten the rules on how and when police can seize private property.
We were able to take millions and millions of dollars from drug dealers. Some of those assets that we were able to take from drug dealers were used to pay things for law enforcement.
Also tonight, proposed changes to the state's family law statute are personal to many of Florida's lawmakers.
Listed right there in the paperwork, every Wednesday night and every other weekend. And then it's a mumbo-jumbo about what holidays I get to see my kids. And it was the same thing as issuing me a death warrant.
And we'll get updates on final week bill action in the legislature, including a measure to compensate families of Dozier Boys School victims. And we'll dabble a little bit in some presidential politics as well. I'm Tom Flanagan. Only 3 days left in the 2016 Florida legislative session, and this is Capitol Report. We start this evening's Capitol Report with the only news out of the legislative session that actually matters, at least as far as the state's constitution is concerned. A proposed $82.3 billion budget for the upcoming fiscal year went to lawmakers at 7 minutes before 3 this afternoon. That clears the way for approval Friday, the last day of the 2016 legislative session. The state constitution requires a 72-hour review period before the legislature can vote on the budget. Land O'Lakes Republican House Appropriations Chairman Richard Corcoran and Senate Appropriations Chair Tom Lee, Republican from Brandon, finished negotiations last night. Well, for the moment at least, we've moved out of the studio for this part of Capitol Report. You can probably tell by the big wash of reverb here behind my voice. I'm sitting in the Senate chamber of the beautifully restored historic Florida Capitol, which sits in all of its 1902 vintage glory in the shadow of the present Capitol building that dates from the early 1970s. Of course, that's where the Senate and the House are meeting today. But there's a chance, now this is purely speculative at this point, that this old Senate chamber could once again see some real legislative action. And that's because the Senate chamber in the so-called new Capitol is scheduled for a $6 million remodeling that's supposed to begin almost as soon as senators vacate the chamber following this Friday's scheduled end of session. Now, should lawmakers need to reconvene in special session, say because they want to override Governor Rick Scott's expected vetoes of member projects, something that his office has kind of hinted at because he's disappointed in the way the budget deal has gone, well, the Senate would have few options of where to meet. I'm sitting in one of those possibilities right now. Again, all this is very much iffy at this point, and we'll keep you posted here on Capitol Report as Friday's sine die gets closer. Okay, we're back in the studio now. Civil asset forfeiture changes are on their way to Governor Rick Scott. Nick Evans reports the House approved the reform package today.
It doesn't happen all the time, but every so often an issue comes along that unites activists on the right and the left.
In fact, around the country, you have interest groups as diverse as the ACLU and libertarian groups like Cato and Reason Foundation that have joined together and called this problem out.
That's St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis. He gained approval for civil asset forfeiture changes last week in the Senate.
By fiscal policy, criminal justice, and Senator Brandis and others, CS for...
Tuesday in the House, it was Yalaha Republican Representative Larry Metz's turn.
Representative Metz, you're recognized. Explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members, Senate Bill 1044 is the civil asset forfeiture reform bill that I presented yesterday.
The controversial procedure allows law enforcement agencies to seize property officers believe is connected with crime. But the practice has raised concerns because seizures don't require an arrest, and in some cases, agencies have clearly abused the system. What's more, a report last year from the legislature's research agency depicts a patchwork of different policies with little oversight. Only about half the state's police and sheriff's departments even responded to researchers' requests. But law enforcement agencies say it's important to preserve the practice. And on the House floor Tuesday, Jacksonville Republican Representative Charles McBurney explains why.
Members, civil asset forfeiture is a very important tool of law enforcement. In my previous life, when I was an assistant state attorney, I handled civil asset forfeiture cases. We were able to take millions and millions of dollars from drug dealers. Some of those assets that we were able to take from drug dealers were used to pay things for law enforcement.
That's the rub. Law and order types like forfeiture because it takes money from criminals and puts it to work fighting crime. But civil liberty types, again, from all across the political spectrum, see this as a perverse incentive, encouraging law enforcement to take property to fund police operations. A measure championed by Brandis last year would have addressed that incentive by sending all forfeiture proceeds to charity. It failed under fierce criticism from the state's law enforcement community. But Metz says this year things are a bit different.
There were actually two bills filed on this subject matter this session. The two Senate sponsors, Senator Bean and Senator Brandis, along with the House members, myself and Representative Caldwell, came together and merged the bills into what you have before you. And I appreciate the Florida Sheriff's Association and the Florida Chief of Police Association for their hard work in helping us get to a consensus bill.
So how they do it? The compromise measure raises the charity contribution level from 15 to 25%. It also mandates a number of new oversight and transparency procedures. Before agencies can seize a person's assets, they'll need to make an arrest. And once the matter comes up in court, the state will have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the asset is the product of a crime. This is the same standard as a criminal case. Under current law, the burden is a bit lower, just clear and convincing evidence. The measure is now on its way to the governor, and it passed the House and Senate unanimously. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
After a veto last year, Florida lawmakers have a family law proposal they hope will get past the governor's pen. Regan McCarthy has more.
Last year, Scott vetoed an alimony overhaul bill due in part to concerns about retroactivity. This year, Melbourne Republican Representative Rich Workman says the new alimony proposal should be in the clear.
When I say this bill, I mean an alimony reform bill that looked nothing like this bill and was retroactive, and quite honestly, was correctly vetoed by the governor based on that point. But today, we have a bill that is not retroactive.
But others, like Lantana Democratic Representative Lori Berman, say it's not so clear to them that the new measure doesn't impact old alimony arrangements. Berman proposed an amendment Tuesday that could help clarify that.
The Senate staff analysis, starting on page 18, questions the potential unconstitutional retroactive application of this bill, especially to prior contractual marriage settlement agreements. During questioning, the sponsor said the bill is not retroactive and pointed to the section that is being amended. The language is ambiguous, and this amendment clarifies it.
But Workman says he thinks Berman has a different goal. He says Berman's move is an attempt to make the family law bill seem retroactive. Berman's amendment failed, but retroactivity isn't the only concern she raised. Berman says she's also worried about the uneven application of a rule that would let payers return to court when a recipient's salary increases, but doesn't let payees do the same. And Berman isn't the only one who's concerned about that. Miami Democratic Representative Cynthia Stafford has a similar worry.
The bill says, in essence, if there is an alimony, an award in alimony, and there is an increase in the payor's income, things will not change. But increases in the recipient's income is a grounds for reduction. This is one-sided and unfair.
The measure also makes changes to custody decisions by requiring judges to start with the premise that relatively equal time with both parents is in the best interest of the children. Workman says the issue is personal for him.
When I walked into my lawyer's office, he gave me the standard forms that he used regarding child share, child custody, and it listed right there in the paperwork. Every Wednesday night and every other weekend, and then some mumbo jumbo about what holidays I get to see my kids. And it was the same thing as issuing me a death warrant.
Workman says he worked out a plan to share his children equally, but says he had to pay for that by taking on an unequal debt load during his divorce. He says he wants to ensure other fathers aren't faced with that situation. But others, like Stafford, worry an equal timeshare premise creates a problematic situation for someone without a lot of money to spend on litigation.
If a father has been uninvolved in a child's life, like in a paternity case, he's presumed or premised to get equal time sharing. And if he's going to use it, the mom has to pay to litigate to overcome that premise. And further, if he gets equal time sharing, his child support is reduced. So a bad father will be able to use a child that he has no intention of spending meaningful time with, who'll be able to use that child as a tool to lower child support payments.
But despite concerns, the measure passed. The bill heads next to the governor for approval. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, for years, Florida's jails and prisons have been the state's primary mental health and addiction treatment facilities. But now the legislature is moving away from the old lock them up and throw away the key approach by setting aside more money for mental health courts.
The present system, with so many people with mental health illnesses, the present system is ineffective and expensive and frankly inhumane.
A bill is now on its way to the governor aimed at helping those who want to rebury their loved ones found on grounds of the former Dozier School for Boys.
I would say that this is a start towards that closure for the families who have lost someone. Whether or not the state is going to issue a formal apology is going to be completely left up to the cabinet.
And with just a week to go before the Florida presidential preference primary election, we'll hear about an exciting new candidate grabbing the imagination of some voters called None of the Above.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Since the 1970s, the hard-on-crime ethos has fueled the era of mass incarceration. Simultaneously, the country defunded public mental health services. A ballooning criminal justice system came in to fill that vacuum. As Kate Payne reports, now the Florida legislature is poised to reform the way mental illness is handled in the system.
Many call America's criminal justice system a de facto mental health system, and Florida is no different. On any given day in the Sunshine State, there are 40,000 people with serious mental illness involved in the criminal justice system, and many of those offenses directly result from untreated mental illness. Mark Mahan, chief judge of the state's 4th Judicial District, says the system has to change.
The present system, with so many people with mental health illnesses, the present system is ineffective and expensive and frankly inhumane.
Now, some state lawmakers are offering proposals that could stem the flow of these people into the correctional system and help them once they're there. Representative Charles McBurney of Jacksonville and Senator Miguel Diaz de la Portilla of Miami want to divert people with mental illness away from incarceration and towards care. McBurney says his eyes were first opened to the issue during his time as an assistant state attorney.
And it seemed that case after case that I dealt with usually were one of two matters. There was substance abuse or mental illness. And quite often it was both. It was substance abuse because of mental illness. And there just simply wasn't anything we could do for most instances except incarcerate.
McBurney's bill would pave the way for mental health courts, which offer an alternative to incarceration and emphasize the importance of treatment and therapy. McBurney says the aim of these and other diversion programs is to reduce recidivism.
So the mental health court structure is similar to for example, and pattern upon drug courts, which have been very successful. In addition, this bill expands veteran courts, particularly in those situations where the criminal justice system intersects, such as probation or community control.
Senator John Legge of Lutz and Representative Kathleen Peters of St. Pete want to support people with mental illness once they have entered the criminal justice system. Their reforms focus specifically on defendants who are incompetent to stand trial because of mental illness or disability. These defendants are then transferred from jails into therapy programs. This bill would keep defendants on the same medications when they make that transition. John Bryant is an assistant secretary for mental health at the Department of Children and Families.
They arrive with medication from the jail, yet once they arrive at our facility, refuse to take that medication.
With medication and therapy, some regain the ability to stand trial, and a hearing may be scheduled. The bill would set a timeline for these hearings to take place. Here's Bryant again.
Although 85% of the courts basically have scheduled a hearing and have that court hearing scheduled within 30 days, there's about 15% of the individuals that we have residing within our facilities who have not had that hearing scheduled. We believe that it's important to ensure that those individuals who do, you know, have the same rights as everybody else.
But some may not recover, may never stand trial, and may ultimately be released. Dan Hendrickson served as assistant public defender for 25 years and now works for the Big Bend Mental Health Coalition. Hendrickson wants the system to do more for people re-entering society.
The issue for people being in the hospital is not just to solve the competency, but to figure out what's going to happen when they get back home.
The House has passed both bills unanimously, and a full Senate vote is expected before the end of session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A bill to help provide closure for families impacted by the now-closed Dozier School for Boys is headed to Governor Rick Scott. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's the former North Florida Reform School surrounded by allegations of abuse and deaths over a span of decades.
Last month, the measure by Senate Democratic leader Athenia Joyner unanimously passed the Florida Senate.
This is our opportunity to say to those families, we share in your grief. This will never be tolerated again in the state of Florida. And the Florida Senate today says, we apologize, and this is the least that we can do.
It had been smooth sailing for the Senate bill, but not so much in the House. The House bill is carried by Tampa Democratic Representative Ed Narain.
It allows the families of the deceased from the author Dozier School for Boys to be reimbursed up to $7,500 to conduct a proper burial. It also establishes a task force to make recommendations for a potential memorial and a location of the site.
Over the past couple of years, University of South Florida researchers had found 51 remains of boys on the Mariana property and 55 unmarked graves and have positively ID'd 7 using DNA matches. The cost for reburial efforts can be costly, and the Florida Cabinet also agreed to making sure there's a memorial in place for the unclaimed remains. Ocala Democratic Representative Dennis Baxley is among those who like the bill.
Department of Juvenile Justice has made tremendous gains. And I've even heard testimony of young men's lives that were changed at Dozier. But there's a dark stain that embarrasses and hurts all of us, and especially the pain of these families. I certainly have the deepest of pain to think that on behalf of the state that some atrocities went down there and that people were harmed, young children.
The Melbourne Beach Republican Representative John Tobiah tried to lower the reimbursement to the families who want to rebury their loved ones' remains to $2,000.
So I consulted a funeral director, asked how much this type of service would cost, was told that it would be less than $2,000. So I said, this makes sense that we should cap it at a reasonable amount. Just because a tragedy may or may not have happened does not mean that the state should expend funds that we have places that can be used currently. And that's why I think $2,000 is a lot more reasonable than $7,500.
Several Democrats questioned the need for the amendment, including St. Petersburg Representative Daryl Ruson.
Isn't it a fact that the bill only allows reimbursement up to $7,500 and it doesn't actually give an appropriation of $7,500 to a family that applies?
Tobia later agreed to withdraw the amendment after Tallahassee Democratic Representative Alan Williams asked him about whether he'd visited the Dozier grounds.
Coming up with the analysis and the number that you've put forth, have you had an opportunity to visit the Dozier school where these young men were laid to rest to understand what the cost would be?
I have had the opportunity. Have I taken up that opportunity? Absolutely not. And I would be more, I drove by it, I believe, last weekend. I would be more than willing to go. And I'll tell you what, why at this juncture, I'd like to withdraw the amendment and take Representative Williams up on the opportunity to get out there and visit the site.
Still, calling Tobias' earlier remarks, quote, naive and insensitive, Narain says the bill is needed as a start to give some sort of closure to those families.
According to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice, more than a tragedy happened at Dozier. In the eyes of any human being with a heart and a soul, the unimaginable happened at Dozier. So I stand here to echo the sentiments of Leader Joyner, of Attorney General Bondi, Commissioner Putnam, and former Governor Bob Martinez when I say these boys that were placed in the state's hands deserve better than unmarked graves. Their families deserve better than to be told that they ran away. The restoration of human dignity begins with the passage of this bill.
And the measure passed the House 114-3, which included Tobia in the dissenting vote. And with that, the bill now awaits the governor's approval. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Governor Rick Scott's bill signing pen was getting a real workout today. He signed 16 bills into law, including a bill that will provide legal protections for Good Samaritans who break into locked cars to rescue animals and vulnerable people. The measure, which became effective with Scott's signature, focuses on situations such as when pets, senior citizens, and children are trapped in hot cars. It'll provide legal immunity for damage that rescuers might cause to vehicles while trying to help the animals or vulnerable people. Another new law would broaden a public records exemption as part of an issue stemming from the Ultimate Fighter television show. The mixed martial arts company Ultimate Fighting Championship taped the show last year in Florida with matches shown at later dates. A Senate staff analysis said UFC contended a broadened public records exemption for proprietary business information was needed because of concerns that the results of the taped matches could become public before the broadcasts. Another new law would, in part, remove people under the age of 18 from being prosecuted for prostitution. This is part of a larger effort to offer more protections for victims of human trafficking. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, as we reported at the top of the show, the Florida legislature has passed a budget, so most of what lawmakers call heavy lifting is now over for the session. Having now reached a relatively tranquil patch in the legislative stream, we can at least temporarily turn our attention to the political maelstrom that's literally taking the nation by storm, the race for the presidency of the United States. Floridians are heading to the polls in the run-up to the state's March 15th presidential primary. Voters will decide who they want to be, the Democratic and Republican presidential nominees. But this election cycle is turning out to be nothing like most watchers expected, and some voters are deeply conflicted on who to choose. Lynn Hatter reports on a third option, the blank ballot, or as some call it, the protest vote.
Karen Williams is the records manager at the Leon County Supervisor of Elections office. She sat down to answer a few questions about the blank ballot option.
Well, a blank ballot is just like any other ballot you would request via
absentee ballot, one be mailed to you or at the precinct. It's a regular ballot that you're issued, but you do not have to vote all of the races on the ballot. And in this case, there's only one race this election, so people don't have to vote on it. They just cast their ballot with no votes on it.
Now, in Florida, our primaries, including this one, are closed. So could someone who is no party affiliated or an independent, could they vote?
No, because like I said, it's the same ballot we would issue. You just would choose not to cast a vote in that race. You wouldn't mark your ballot, in which case it is a blank ballot. If there's multiple races, which we say you don't have to vote every race on your ballot because you might not want to cast a vote in a particular race, then it's still a marked ballot that's just a blank race. But since there's only one race on this ballot, it makes it a blank ballot.
So when we talk about a blank ballot, what exactly do we mean? Is someone getting just a blank piece of paper, or do they get the Democratic or Republican ballot and they just don't bubble in names?
They're getting a regular ballot, just like any other voter would get, because we don't know that they're going to cast, nor will we ever know who has cast a blank ballot because it's secret voting. So it's the regular Democratic ballot or the Republican ballot that the voter chooses not to vote on.
Do blank ballots count? How are they tabulated, and how do they fall into the way that we tally votes in Florida?
The voter will not have marked in the race to have cast a vote in that race. They have cast a ballot. Our voting equipment, for example, at the precinct, they will not accept a blank ballot because they're assuming that, you know, you would like to vote your ballot. So in that situation, the machine will kick it out, and then the voter places it in the auxiliary bin, which is in the voting machine, and those ballots go to our canvassing board, which determine whether they are truly unmarked, not voted ballots, and then they are run through as a blank ballot batch and accounted for that way. But as far as like tallying their votes, there's no vote to tally, but their ballot is recorded.
So basically, you voted, but you didn't.
You didn't cast a vote in that race, but you cast a ballot.
Early voting is underway in Florida now. When is the last day to early vote before the March 15th primary?
This Saturday is the last day of early voting, which is March the 12th.
Great. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.